From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Washington Watch during Thanksgiving week. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins. Sarah Perry here, your Director of Partnerships. During his campaign for the presidency, Bill Clinton said that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And he won the White House in part because he was a moderate. But now the Democratic presidential candidates are in lockstep together in support for abortion up until birth, with the exception of Representative Tulsi Gabbard and Senator Amy Klobuchar. In just a minute, I'll talk with Alexandra DeSantis of the National Review about her column on the issue. In my second and third segments, the school board for Palatine, Illinois High School decided last Thursday in a 5-2 vote to allow gender-confused students to choose which restrooms and locker rooms reflect their gender identity and to use the same. Not surprisingly, the female students are fearful and angry. I'll talk with Jonathan Van Maren, a columnist at LifeSite News, about the decision. And at 42 past the hour, since Thanksgiving is just a few days away, I'll talk about the real story of the Pilgrims, the first Thanksgiving, and the Christian heritage of America. Dr. Paul Jaley of the Plymouth Rock Foundation will join me to discuss. As a reminder, go to our podcast website at tonyperkins.com. There you will find associated resources and guest information. You can watch Dr. Paul Jaley's presentation on the Pilgrims' ideas, FRC Action's party platform comparison between Democrats and Republicans, and check out FRC's pro-life map so you can see if your state protects babies born alive after a failed abortion. Follow Tony on Twitter at PT Perkins, or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, Alexandra DeSantis wrote recently in a column for the Washington Post that Democrats have purged safe, legal, and rare from the party's vernacular, and wrote that safe, legal, and rare used to be a common Democratic talking point coined, as we discussed, by President Bill Clinton. This was a signal of his desire to protect what he saw as a right to abortion, but also acknowledging the views of people who had understandable moral qualms about the practice, maybe even winning over a few to his side. But today, the party's base is unwilling to tolerate a slogan that suggests abortion ought to be rare, seeing it as they do as a fundamental human right and hearing in that slogan too much of a concession to their opponents. Joining me now is Alexandra DeSantis with the National Review to talk further about her Washington Post column and some follow-up. Alexandra, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You have concluded that most Democratic candidates have erased from their rhetoric any hint that abortion might be a subject on which reasonable people can disagree for reasons moral, ethical, religious, or otherwise. Why are they suddenly eliminating the possibility of like-minded disagreement among those who might be their opponents? There is no quarter given for these individuals. Why that?
You know, I think it's been kind of a sudden process we've seen over the last maybe 10 or so years. And that's the contrast I tried to draw in the piece, even between, someone like Hillary Clinton. It wasn't just Bill. Hillary running in 2008 during the primary against Barack Obama even repeated the phrase safe, legal, and rare. And she would add, and by rare, I mean rare. And so it wasn't all that long ago that right. Democratic Party leaders were talking in this language. And I think what we've seen is this kind of shift where very pro-abortion groups like Planned Parenthood and NARAL and other, sort of hardcore abortion rights activist groups and individuals sort of hijack the left on this issue and take so much control over the movement sort of optically and in terms of messaging and even funding that Democratic politicians feel like they don't have much of a choice other than to go along.
Well, last Wednesday, we saw yet another Democratic debate. MSNBC was hosting. Rachel Maddow was moderating. She asked Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota this particular question about abortion. Let's listen.
Welcome back to the MSNBC Washington Post Democratic Candidates Debate. Many states, including right here where we are tonight in Georgia, have passed laws that severely limit or outright ban abortion. Right now, Roe versus Wade protects a woman's right to abortion nationwide. But if Roe gets overturned and abortion access disappears in some states, would you intervene as president to try to bring that access back, Senator Klobuchar?
Well, of course. We should codify Roe v. Wade into law. That is what we should do. And this president indicated early on what he was going to do, and he's done it.
So the codification of Roe versus Wade was a repeated talking point during the debate and prior in earlier debates as well. This is sort of a repeated mantra for all of the Democratic presidential hopefuls. But it's what Rachel Maddow asked Senator Warren of Massachusetts about specifically what the Democratic Party stands for. What's emblematic for the Dems related to abortion? Let's listen.
Just this weekend, Louisiana reelected a Democratic governor, John Bel Edwards. He has signed one of the country's toughest laws restricting abortion. Is there room in the Democratic Party for someone like him, someone who can win in a deep red state but who does not support abortion rights? Senator Warren.
I believe that abortion rights are human rights. I believe that they are also economic rights. And protecting the right of a woman to be able to make decisions about her own body is fundamentally what we do and what we stand for as a Democratic Party.
So here we go, where the Democratic Party is tolerating no moral reservation. They are codifying Roe versus Wade into law. They are describing abortion rights as human rights. So this is, I'm sure, very exciting to the party's progressive and left-leaning, ever more so, base. But are they going to win a general election with this kind of a radical pro-abort position?
You know, I think it's really tough to say because on one hand, if you look at the public opinion data, I think it's very clear that Democrats on this issue, the further left they move on abortion rights, the more out of step they get with certainly the average American. You know, most Americans would prefer to see abortion limited to the first trimester, if at all. But at the same time, I think they're actually also out of step with their own voters. So a large number of Democrats, it fluctuates from poll to poll, but a large number of Democrats also support at least some restrictions on abortion. And this is not something that any Democratic candidate, for the most part, is willing to concede at all. And so I think in a general election, it's kind of tough, unless, of course, you have kind of media allies helping you cover up exactly how extreme your positions might be on abortion. I think that's where Democrats actually are done a big favor by a lot of journalists.
Well, poor Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, when she cited the phrase safe, legal, and rare, indicating that she would be okay with a prohibition of abortion during the last 3 months of pregnancy, she got a cool reception, which is unfortunate because, just as you've indicated, that third trimester feasibility, the acceptability for the majority of American voters of whatever political stripe. There are 8% of Americans, according to a Harvard Center for American Political Studies Harris poll that took place earlier this year, just 8% of Americans say abortion should be permitted until the third trimester. So we're already looking at an electorate that does not like abortion in the third trimester. And here's what I think is interesting. You actually followed up to your Washington Post column in the National Review, because a letter to the editor had been sent indicating that there were no third trimester abortions that took place. And in fact, it was sort of a mischaracterization of what actually happens. So talk to me about whether or not elective late term abortions are actually taking place.
Yeah, these procedures certainly do happen, and this is a really common talking point we hear from supporters of abortion rights because, as they know, abortion late in pregnancy is really not popular, and so they try to downplay the fact that this exists at all. They say it's rare, when, in fact, if you look at the U.S. data on abortion, there's somewhere around 12,000 of these such procedures every year in the U.S., you know, after in the last 3 months of pregnancy. So they certainly do happen. And some percentage of those, we don't know exactly what percentage, but some percentage of those late-term abortions do happen for elective reasons. And there's sort of this pervasive myth that, well, if a woman is seeking an abortion that late in pregnancy after her fetus is viable, it's only because she has some horrible health condition or the baby has been diagnosed with some horrible health condition. And it's right. always these heartbreaking circumstances that can't be helped. And unfortunately, that's simply not the case. And there are abortionists on record. There are abortion clinics that publicly say we will do abortion, elective abortions up to, you know, 32 weeks, or we'll have women come in and not realize they were pregnant until the third trimester and now they want an abortion. These things, unfortunately, do happen, and reporting and studies indicate the same thing.
So poor Tulsi Gabbard, after mentioning safe, legal, and rare, the Twitterverse blew up. The Ohio affiliate of NARAL tweeted, "This is a position making abortion rare, not supported by pro-choice advocates." And a headline in Vice said Gabbard was stuck in the 90s. The article's author, Marley Solis, argued that the candidate had revived a decades-old talking point and that it had further stigmatized abortion at a critical moment. But this is the one that really took me aback. Amelia Bonow, co-founder of the group Shout Your Abortion. And again, here's where we go from abortion as elective procedure, a choice, supporting a choice, to this is a fundamental human right and an expression of our femininity, said, "I cannot think of a less compelling way to advocate for something than saying that it should be rare. And anyone who uses the phrase is operating from the assumption that abortion is a bad thing." Well, even moderate Democrats among us could agree that this was not an ideal choice, and that well-minded conservatives like you and I could hold disagreements and they would understand why. But Leanna Wen was also very talkative after this, again, former president of Planned Parenthood. She even agreed with Tulsi Gabbard, saying that she appreciated that she brought up the third rail for Democrats. So what we're seeing here is this increasing shift to the left, where even the former president of Planned Parenthood can say, listen, this used to be something on which we could all agree, that we would never get to this third trimester basis. But these are sort of individuals who are of two different perspectives, never thinking that I would actually get to a point where Leanna Wen would be making some sense. Where are these general election Democratic voters on the issue of abortion? Where do they fall in line?
You know, I think if you look at polling data, large numbers of Democrats actually agree that abortion should be legal only in the early stages of pregnancy. And I think a recent Gallup poll showed that something like only 18% of Democrats say they support abortion in the third trimester, which is higher than obviously the rate for most Americans. But still, that's not even, you know, not even 20% of Democrats. And so I think they're really not where the party is on this issue at all.
No, that just shows us where the Democratic candidates are. And perhaps this has weighted the scales a little bit in favor of a political candidate of another stripe, one who protects the fundamental right to life of all citizens, born or unborn. Alexander DeSantis of National Review has been my excellent guest today. You're listening to Washington Watch. Coming up next, a school board in Illinois decided earlier this month to allow gender-confused students to use whatever restroom or locker room they wanted. Not surprisingly, female students are up in arms. I'll talk with Jonathan Van Meren at LifeSite News next.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Clausen addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
Meadow Pollock was a high school senior who was tragically gunned down during the Parkland school shooting in Florida. In an emotional and gripping FRC Speaker Series event, her father, Andrew Pollock, and education expert Max Eden discussed the tragic massacre and the politically correct policies that allowed the Parkland shooting to happen. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Obama administration promoted a false narrative that teachers and principals were racist and couldn't be trusted to enforce rules with consequences. Instead, they argued for healing circles and restorative justice. These policies enabled a psychopathic criminal to maintain a clean background and purchase a firearm used to murder 17 people at the high school. The Obama administration forced these leniency policies into hundreds of schools, serving millions of students across America. To listen to this event and to learn more, visit frc.org/speakers. That's frc.org/speakers.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thanksgiving week, Tuesday. Well, last Thursday, the school board that oversees the Palatine, Illinois High School voted 6-2 to adopt a new policy allowing a gender-confused student to choose which bathroom and locker room whoever students of his kind reflected their gender identity, essentially opening up all private spaces in a form of uncontrolled mayhem. Now, the individual that brought this to my attention, I get a chance to talk to today because while many good things don't happen on Twitter, sometimes good things do. And it was the audio of this interaction by my next guest, who had saved it and tweeted it out, that I want you to listen to. Here is how trans student Nova Madej responded to the school board's decision. Let's listen.
I'm really hoping they vote for it. It's definitely going to be a step forward in progress. I'm really excited if they vote for it. A bit nervous, though, as always, just you never know. But it's definitely a first step forward in many more steps. It's a great policy. Unfortunately, it's not everything we want, such as talking about even the small things like changing the name on your student ID, which you're required to wear at all times. So I'm really hoping that the district makes the right decision here and votes it. Yeah, it passed. It passed.
And how does it make you feel?
Oh, I'm ecstatic.
Now, listen to how Julia Burka, a biological female student who is also a swimmer and opposed the policy change for obvious reasons, responded, and listen to her choke back tears.
I feel uncomfortable that my privacy is being invaded. As I am a swimmer, I do change multiple times naked in front of the other students in the locker room. And I understand that the board has an obligation to all students, but I was hoping that they would go about this in a different way that would also accommodate students such as myself.
Well, joining me now is Jonathan Van Maren, a columnist for LifeSite News, who actually brought this to quite a number of people's attention in the past few days. Jonathan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
So it appears, Jonathan, that this young woman, Julia Burka, the high school student that we heard second in these clips, has more sense than the school board of Palatine, Illinois. And you described her as collateral damage. And really, that is the most precise way to describe her. These biological girls are sort of caught in the crosshairs of bathroom politics, aren't they?
That's precisely the case. And she pointed out, I think, with great grace and dignity, as you saw and heard in that clip, that her privacy was essentially being sacrificed by the board because they were afraid that the transgender activists who have been targeting this particular school board for 4 years were going to get too much pressure from the opposition. And so they failed in their duty to her. And I was actually so impressed by how she responded to something that had obviously upset her in an enormous way.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I have to tell you that as a mother of a 13-year-old girl, the thought of a biological male sharing a private space, whether it's a locker room or a bathroom, with my young teenage daughter makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. But I will say this as well, and I want to say this before we go further. Thank you, Jonathan, for speaking out as a male on the issue. I think there are a lot of females who find themselves sort of screaming into the void, recognizing some of the obvious inaccuracies and the patent unfairness and the safety violations that are inherent in this notion of biological men competing with young women in the same spaces, sharing private spaces with young women, really sort of unraveling all of the legal protections that women worked so hard to maintain post-sexual revolution. So thank you, as a male, for calling this out. And this really stirred up a hornet's nest. And this was not just a quiet decision. What was going on at this meeting attended by almost 500 community members?
Well, what's really interesting in this particular instance is that this is a school in Illinois, which, as most of your listeners will know, is a very liberal state. But so many parents had precisely the reaction that you had. They were furious when they found out that the board was going to kowtow and was going to essentially permit anybody who identifies as female to enter the bathrooms. And what's important to note here is that there is no standard now for determining who is and who is not a female, because the person that we're talking about can be pre-operative, post-operative. They can be in full possession of healthy functioning male genitalia and still be permitted to enter into, in this case, the female locker room. And many parents were understandably outraged. And a lot of the people who were outraged, their outrage doesn't actually indicate what their opinion is on the issue of transgenderism at large. It is simply an instinctive reaction that biological males should not be permitted to see young girls changing naked in the change room. And this used to be common sense. The attitude of the girl, Julia, who spoke, used to be lauded by people, but it does appear that the world has gone slightly mad on the issue of gender, and one of the reasons for that is because we've removed any defining characteristics, and thus we are basically left to allowing people to make whatever decision they want on the assumption that this is always going to work out well for everybody involved.
I think you're absolutely right. And I have to say that there really was something that felt very backhanded, very hidden, almost nefarious, because the school board rejected a proposal to let the community vote on the question in a district-wide referendum. And they didn't even allow that opportunity. So in a 5-2 decision, this school board panel decides unilaterally they are going to open everything up to both sexes, regardless of, like you said, present medically, where you are in the transition scale. This is self-identification, which, to my mind, as a parent, as a female, really opens up a Pandora's box, because if we are now calling ourselves one thing, regardless of how we appear, regardless of what our biological reality indicates, we have essentially thrown common sense to the wind, and there is no end to what we are willing to sacrifice, starting with our biology. Jonathan, stay with me. We're going to talk some more after the break on Washington Watch.
The topic of sexual sin can be difficult to discuss in the church, but it's something that needs to be addressed. To help inform this conversation, FRC has a new publication for church leaders called Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. In it, Dr. Jesse Gill, a licensed psychologist, specifically addresses sexual sin and the susceptibility of those in church leadership. He discusses the contributing factors to moral failure, a practical understanding of our sexual nature, and a call for Christian leaders to increase their dependency on Christ. The principles found in this publication will instruct leaders in meeting their emotional, relational, and even sexual needs in healthy ways so that there will be less of a foothold for temptation. Safeguard Your Ministry for Moral Failure is a must-read for everyone involved in church ministry. To read the publication and learn more, visit frc.org/safeguard. That's frc.org/safeguard.
Are you a parent of a school-aged child? If so, then you understand that navigating your educational system is one of the biggest challenges facing families across the United States today. Family Research Council's new publication titled The SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know, helps parents identify and monitor a specific agenda that is being pushed on their children in public schools. The highly partisan left-wing Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the greatest offenders on this front with their program titled Teaching Tolerance. This program is designed to infiltrate schools with radically progressive education resources that undermine Christian values about marriage and family. FRC's brochure outlines the content within the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project and empowers parents to protect their children against the SPLC's agenda. Learn more at frc.org/teachingtolerance. That's frc.org/teachingtolerance.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am still with Jonathan Van Maren of LifeSite News. We're talking the transgender movement and a recent decision coming out of Palatine, Illinois. Jonathan, we were talking before about how this rather nefarious decision by the school board and the inability for students and parents in the district to have a say really puts a bad taste in our mouths. This kind of underscores why we as conservatives, we as Christians, need to run for local office like school board, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And just to put a slightly positive spin on that, because I have found the sheer rate that the transgender juggernaut has been marching at to be quite terrifying at times, is the fact that they did not allow parents to vote indicates that they know that the parents would not have voted for the decision that they made.
Right.
And it's been interesting, the reaction to the video that I posted, it's been viewed 5.7 million times.
Yes, it
on
has.
Twitter, I believe. Even Donald Trump Jr., who only a few weeks ago had commented that he didn't really care about this bathroom war issue, it was kind of an annoying sideshow, even he retweeted it out, which indicates that once he saw those two interviews, he realized what a big deal this was. And so one of the things with the transgender movement is that it's a top-down ideology. It's being imposed by a handful of people that have an enormous amount of control and influence in the media, in progressive politics, and in the entertainment industry. And we do, precisely as you say, need people to stand up, run for office, and speak out before this thing takes root too effectively.
Yes, because so much of education, because it is done right in certain areas, is managed locally, which is all the more reason, A, to elect good candidates, or B, to run yourself, because that is the only way to affect real ground-level change. We as women also, and I want to mention this, you know, we have an inborn warning detection system, right? We have a natural desire to protect our own privacy, and yet we're seeing these individuals being told, well, ignore your anxiety, your privacy concerns, because someone else's gender identity, their feelings, in effect, matter more than your physical safety. How do you possibly justify that in the era of Me Too?
Well, there are a couple of notes to make about that. The first is that this decision was more egregious than immediately meets the eye, which is saying something, because one of the previous policies had been to allow those with gender dysphoria to have their own changing space, which meant that the young man who expressed such ecstasy at that decision didn't have to change in the boys' room if he didn't want to. He had a space set aside for him, which most of us can agree, okay, if this person's struggling with gender dysphoria, let's make an allowance to ensure that he doesn't have to go where he's uncomfortable. That was rejected, and what the transgender movement wanted was for him to be able to change with the girls. So a very reasonable compromise that would have protected the privacy of the girls was rejected entirely. The second thing that I think is important for the listeners to realize is that the sheer amount of hatred coming from the hashtag Love Wins crowd is really quite bone-chilling. And if any of you have had the misfortune of going beneath that video on my Twitter page and reading a lot of the replies, and I mean replies from high-ranking LGBT activists, transgender activists, not just anonymous egghead Twitter accounts. I'm talking people with an excess of 20,000 followers. Right. They're saying things like, I drink white bigot tears. This girl is just a transphobe. She needs to get over herself. And then a laundry list of other things that I can't say in polite company or on air. But this was their reaction to the dignified response of a girl while she tries to hold back tears to the announcement that adults had dictated that her privacy was no longer of major concern. And when you read the tweet that these people are saying in public, blue checkmarked activists, you get a really up-close look at what their ideology is and how much hatred they actually hold.
I could not agree more. This isn't about equality. It's about supremacy. There is no deviation whatsoever, and it is supremacy from the standpoint that we are more important than your physical safety, your biological identity. And my only explanation for this, for the level of vitriol we hear and see, particularly coming from the transgender movement, is the fact that to repeat a lie, you have to say it louder and louder and more often before it begins to sound and feel like the truth. The parents there were outraged. Is that an emblematic response to how the rest of us feel? Or are there more who align themselves with this trans religious cult than we actually know?
So the answer to that question is both. So we do have an increasingly large number of parents who think that because this is what the Democratic Party is advocating for, as we saw with that LGBTQ CNN town hall, this is what most of the mainstream media is saying. You'll notice that just like clockwork and all around the same time, every major media organization switched to saying phrases like his breasts or her penis. At the behest of the trans crowd. You can read phrases like that in the Washington Post, the New York Times. And so there's some people who read these things. They have no foundational view of the world that helps to inform them on things like gender. And they say, oh, I guess this must be the case. On the flip side, you have an enormous number of parents who think this is just garbage because they understand that boys are boys and girls are girls. There are dads who remember what it was like to be a teenage boy in high school. There are girls, women who remember what it was like to be a girl in high school, and they aren't educated enough to believe in a lot of this stupidity. G.K. Chesterton's always said that we need to be educated because otherwise we will be in deadly danger of taking educated people too seriously. And you're seeing the common sense people really saying, I'm sorry, that is nonsense. And this, by the way, is happening around the Western world. This is happening in the United Kingdom, in Canada, and the United States.
John, I got to cut you off.
Students are standing up.
John Van Maren of LifeSite News will be right back here on Washington Watch to talk about the origins of Thanksgiving.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. TonyPerkins.com for today's resources and shareable information, including information on our guests and some follow-along material on the subjects we've discussed today. Follow Tony on Twitter at T. Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, we are 2 days away from Thanksgiving, so we're going to leave the world of policy and politics for a minute, and we're going to talk about gratitude and a little bit of history to determine whether or not what you've been told about the origins of Thanksgiving are, in fact, accurate. It's not just a time to eat good food and watch football and spend time with family. It goes to the greater issue of gratitude and what it looks like to be thankful despite incredible hardship. Joining me now to tell us the real story of the Pilgrims, the first Thanksgiving, and the Christian heritage of America is Dr. Paul Jaley. He's the president of Plymouth Rock Foundation, the senior pastor of the New Testament Church, and the founding principal of the New Testament Christian School. Dr. Jaley, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you. Yes, 2 days away from Thanksgiving, and quite a heritage we have in this nation with that holiday.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about it because this is one of those history lessons that I think over the years has gotten a little convoluted. So let's talk a little bit about the Pilgrims themselves, because before they even got on the Mayflower in 1620, there is kind of an amazing backstory, because when they tried to separate from the Church of England, they were severely persecuted. And this is a part of the Thanksgiving story I think so many of us are wont to forget. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Pilgrims, of course, were children of the Reformation, and there was a major revival brewing in England that historians later have called the revival of hearth and home, meaning that after the translation of the Geneva Bible in 1560, it was the first Bible small enough to carry, cheap enough to own, had chapters and verses, marginal notes for study, and all of a sudden more and more families owned their own Bible. And this began to spread a revival in the home. Fathers reading to their children from the pages of Scripture. First time in history that was taking place within the homes of England. And, of course, this began to be a large swell in certain pockets of England. William Bradford talks about the origin of the Pilgrim Church being in the Reformation, that massive revival that touched every area of life. And so the Pilgrims then, however, as Bradford puts it, as soon as they were getting converted and their pastors and preachers began to see, hey, wait a minute, the way the state church operates is not the way the Bible instructs us to, and they started to meet in their homes. They started to meet outside the established church. Most people are forgetting the fact that at this time in England, King James was the head of, as it was Elizabeth, of both the church and the state. Right. So whenever you centralize power, you're going to have these kinds of issues, because the preachers were told they had to be licensed by the state, and that means their sermons had to be critiqued. And all of these things took place, and therefore they went underground. And what the Pilgrim Church is a remnant church in England that was willing to form a covenant from the bottom up, from believers that, and as the Bradford relates it, they made a covenant of the Lord into a church estate, and they were going to follow in all of God's ways, whatsoever it should cost them. And, of course, that's Bradford writing years later, and, of course, as he says in his history, and that it cost them something, this ensuing history will declare.
Now, tell us a little bit about William Bradford. I've heard you mention him, but where does he fall into this Pilgrim historical era in terms of his relationship to the Pilgrims and to Thanksgiving itself?
Well, William Bradford, by the time he was 4 or 5 years of age, he's lost both his mother and father. He's raised by his uncles. He's an individual living in a farming country up there in northern England and the northern parts of England, as it's called. And so William Bradford's growing up between the ages of 7 and 11. He was so sick he barely could go outside. He later would write after his conversion that he was spared the vices of youth. He gets converted at 12 years of age, walking 8 miles one way to a separatist congregation. And there he reads the Geneva Bible. He hears the preaching of Richard Clifton. He gets converted to Christ. His uncles are furious. He's left the separatist, the church of... a church, and he's only 14, and so they say, listen, you're going to ruin your inheritance. He actually gets up in front of all his relatives and talks about being willing to suffer for Christ. Mm. That's the most important thing to him. He's a 14-year-old standing up for Christ, and by the time he's a teenager, he's in jail in Boston, England, when the Pilgrims try to escape to Holland. And so he's barely 18 when they get to Holland, and he's only just turning 30 when the Mayflower set sail, and now he's one of the leaders. And, of course, once he arrives here, he loses his wife, Dorothy, who falls overboard and drowns. And here is William Bradford becoming governor of the colony at about 30 years of age after John Carver dies. But he's also an historian. He's a scholar. He studies Hebrew by candlelight here in the wilderness. He is an individual that is a historian. He's the historian of the colony. So we owe a lot to his veracity, his justice, the way he would govern. A lot to say about William Bradford, and of course he never refers to himself much in his own history. He's a very humble man.
So this is incredible. It makes it a little bit difficult for those who claim that America was not a Christian nation to actually hold fast to that premise, considering that the nation itself was founded on the principles of religious freedom, which we understand, obviously, being students of history, but also holding fast to the notion of worshiping as we wish. But also it is this pervasive narrative. We are told that there is no Christian heritage to America, but clearly you and I would disagree with that, wouldn't we?
Yes, and I think the critical thing is to, when you really look at it, the Pilgrims would never have set sail if it were not for their faith. Mm. It was their faith, their convictions in Scripture, the fact that they were persecuted and had no religious liberty and had to go to Holland, have some aspect of religious toleration, which is distinct from religious liberty, but still they had that in Holland until the truce with Spain was going to end and a lot of issues came that they had to leave by 1620 if they wanted to continually live out their liberty of conscience. And it's not, you know, the Pilgrims' form of religious liberty is not fully flower until years later in the Great Awakening and all the rest in America, but still you have those seeds coming with the Pilgrims. But certainly any honest historian would admit that though there were others not of their Leiden congregation on the Mayflower, certainly there would be no hiring of the Mayflower, no purchase of the Speedwell, no voyage at all if it were not for their faith in God, their adherence to the Scriptures. And they wanted to form a local town built on covenant. And they were also very unique, even from the Puritans, because the Puritans were suffering from, and we everyone all understand it, a state-run church. But then when they often came to New England, they switched it around to a church-run state. And neither are a biblical aspect. And, of course, John Robinson, the pastor of the Pilgrims, said, look, you can't, don't fault us. We haven't had the Bible very long to mine its truths on every area of life yet.
Right. But we have a little learning curve we've got to make
up. We have a learning curve to go here. But the Pilgrims, very uniquely, when they signed that Mayflower Compact on board the ship, you did not have to be a member of their Leiden congregation to vote for civil office. That was huge. Mm. That was massive. Way ahead of
its
time.
Absolutely.
And, of course, when they left their socialistic kind of endeavor of a communal property in 1623, that was also way ahead of its time.
These individuals, these pilgrims, went first to Holland, which did not work out for them. And why was that the case?
Well, they worked out fine for about 11 or 12 years. And of course, Holland was the place where all those in the Reformation who were persecuted fled to. And so that worked out okay until... When you get to 1619 and 1620, there was more turmoil, let's say, in Holland, knowing that this truce was going to end. And they recognized, as Bradford wrote, he said, we wanted to propagate and advance the gospel of the kingdom of Christ into the remote parts of the world, yea, though we would be stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. So they had this vision that they would go forth to build and advance the kingdom and knew they were going to be stepping stones. And when you think of what happened, half their number die the first winter. Mm-hmm. They are in tremendous suffering, but more children survived. They thought it was providential that 75 to 79% of the children survived that first winter, and they were here for future generations. Those are the kind of facts and storylines that you need to have around the table.
Yes.
At Thanksgiving, and to just read Edward Winslow's account of the first Thanksgiving, or William Bradford's, they're easily obtained. You can go to our website, Plymrock, PLYMROCK.org, get some materials if you'd like. But the point is that's possible, and I believe your producers have my article on Thanksgiving they can put up as well.
Yes, absolutely. Now, let's talk about that a little bit, about Thanksgiving itself, the first Thanksgiving feast. And I think many of us, many of whom have been products of public school, have heard oft repeated that there was enmity between the Native Americans and the Pilgrims, that there was violence between them. But there is a little bit of a backstory there. So tell us about their relationship and about the Thanksgiving feast itself.
Well, one of the things that you have to realize is when the Pilgrims came here, they had some very clear instructions from their leaders and others that they were to make peace with the natives, not steal their land, not oppress them. Mm-hmm. That had been, unfortunately, the standard, the Doctrine of Discovery, was a horrendous law, a papal bull back in the 1400s. And so they were coming here as a remnant, and they didn't do everything perfectly, but their desire was to have peace. And so you think about it, they have two documents on board that give them, quote, permission from the king. But, of course, they write two documents, the Mayflower Compact, which sets up their government since they were outside the original charter. And then they have a peace with the natives by March of 1621. And this was an agreement to live in peace together, to defend each other if they were unlawfully attacked. And that peace, at some degree and measure, lasted more than 50 years. That's the good news. The bad news is that's probably the longest-lasting peace treaty with Native Americans in our history. And the point is that so when they had that three-day festival in October, probably, which was patterned, by the way, probably after the Feast of Tabernacles, because the Pilgrims were very, very strong in their scholarship of the Old Testament. And they would be calls for prayer in the spring and calls of days of thanksgiving in the fall, very much the pattern of the Feast of Passover and Tabernacles, which was called the Thanksgiving Feast among the Jews. But you had this a pattern long before the Pilgrims came here. But they came, and to have that three-day festival in harmony with the natives and have athletic events, wrestling events, shooting events, who knows what else. And, of course, I always tell people, gee, they didn't keep score. We don't know who won what.
Right.
But we do know that there's a link between athletics and Thanksgiving that some wonder, gee, is that historically accurate? Well, you know, there's some parts of it. Of course, the Thanksgiving festival in October is and the original one is a bit different than all we see in American history. But, of course, we know that the idea of gratitude, of giving thanks, though half your company have died, thanks for the friendship among the natives, and thanks for the very little you have, to be thankful for that rather than constantly complaining about what you think you need that you don't have.
Oh, I have to tell you, Dr. Jaley, that impresses upon my heart really a memorable refrain, because it is truly impossible to have an attitude of despondency when you count your blessings, when you are grateful. And once you see the Lord's providence in your own life, it really can and does reorient your perspectives. That is something that I have so loved about the story of the first Thanksgiving, that even though they had suffered a harsh voyage, had lost many, had survived incredible conditions, they still gave thanks, seeing that the Lord's blessings and benefits were prominent and evident throughout. So to this day, when you hear Thanksgiving mentioned, what is the first sentiment that comes to mind as a studier of history?
Well, for me, it's the doctrine of the providence of God, that God is in control of all things, and that's why we can be grateful, that we don't see the end. We don't see the purposes that God is allowing certain things. We just think of the present and now. One of the reasons why we're going to do an event in 2020 here in Plymouth for the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims, June 28 to 30, and inviting American and especially believers, but everyone, to come is to hear the real story and the facets of these people. You'd have to ask yourself this question. What would happen if a group of Christians were sent into the wilderness to build a society, and they have the Bible and the freedom to build a commonwealth built on that? What would they do first? What would they do second? And what if you chose the best character out of a congregation of 325 out of Leiden that would come, 75, as a remnant into the wilderness? Well, that is the story of New England and the Pilgrims. That's the story in large part of America, because the self-government, the concept of self-rule and self-government, the concept of the rule of law, jurisdictional separation of church and state, not ideological, but jurisdictional, all of these things, economic freedom, all of these things come from this tiny band, only 51 surviving that first winter. And yet that seed, you don't have to be powerful, you don't have to be numerous, you don't have to be wealthy, and you don't have to have everything that you want, but you need to have the right ideas. The most wealthy individuals have the right ideas drawn from the scripture and the character to live it out. And that's what these pilgrims demonstrate. They're never perfect, but critically, influence is far more powerful than power.
Oh, Dr. Paul Jaley of the Plymouth Rock Foundation, what an excellent wise guest with so much history and insight about what this holiday means to us and what our origins really are. The website is plymrock, plymrock.org. He is the director of the Plymouth Rock Foundation. On this Thanksgiving pre-show, we are telling you to remind yourselves of this verse from Psalms, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, his love endures forever. If you sit down and you spend some time thinking, I'll wager that you can find more to be grateful about than to be unhappy about. And so we pray that you join us in being grateful for your blessings this Thanksgiving and always. Happy Thanksgiving from those of us here at Washington Watch. We'll catch you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.